I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Andre Picard, health columnist at the Globe and Mail, author of the upcoming book, Neglected No More, The Urgent Need to Improve the Lives of Canada's Elders in the Wake of a Pandemic. Welcome back.
Hi.
Andre, today, the vaccination rollout. Is Trudeau fucking this up, or am I just getting impatient because I'm selfish and privileged? The answer is yes. Also, misinformation super spreaders. It's a made in Canada bipartisan effort. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
This episode of Canada Land Shortcuts is brought to everybody by Akbar Nurlibayev, Ben Angus, Nicole Penak, Emily Barsanti Innes, Dana Sikora, Sarah Gaspard, Hannah Doucette, and Gabrielle Arquette.
My name is Gabrielle. I'm an herbalist in Southern Ontario, and I support Canada Land because responsible journalism matters to me. Canada Land introduces me to stories, reporters, and perspectives I might not otherwise hear about. I also love that they've been adding more investigative journalism to their offerings and that they're hiring reporters to cover French language and Indigenous beats. Keep up the good work, and thank you for the socks.
The global race for the COVID-19 vaccine is at full throttle.
Canada's sluggish vaccine rollout is supposed to pick up speed this week, though today there was another setback.
Vaccine makers like Moderna promise orders will be filled.
Well, all these delays mean Canada will not hit its vaccine targets.
Andre, I want to try to get some purchase on this, like, the one story right now. There's lots of stories right now, but there's one story which is like, when am I getting jabbed with the vaccine? And I have lost the plot entirely. There's so much noise around this. There's so much emotion around this. It's so politicized. Can I go through some of the different like information sources that I'm trying to make sense of here?
Sure.
There's a lot of editorializing. If I read Matt Gurney in the National Post, he just calls this embarrassing. I think Rex Murphy said the same thing. It's the worst government Canada's ever had. The consensus amongst these pundits is that we're being poorly led in the vaccination rollout, and it's Trudeau's fault. Gurney writes, "We are rich. Canada is a rich country, but we don't act like one." And you know, Globe and Mail's editorial board, other countries are making vaccines. Why can't Canada? You know, Glenn McGregor sharing this list. I'm seeing this list again and again where you see Israel at the top of the list and you go down and you're Spaniards are beating us, for God's sakes. And then we're at like 52. There's just this like consensus that we're failing and other countries are doing so much better than us. And it is. It does get to you when you read, like, okay, fine, Israel. Israel, you know, everybody served in the military. You can get those people to fall into line. They're at 69% vaccination of adult population. But we're used to comparing ourselves favorably against the United States. They're at 15% vaccination for grownups. We're at 3%. The tenor of the anti-Trudeau thing, usually I just like think like people are so irrationally angry at this guy that I dismiss their arguments before I read them sometimes. But then I start to get a little bit angry at him when I read those stats. And then I read Doug Saunders in your newspaper. He says the me first spirit of vaccine nationalism isn't just selfish, it's self-harm. That really, this is a global thing. We're all in it together. And there are other countries that should be getting vaccinated before us because they're being affected in a way that we're not by this. And if they're vaccinated first, that helps the global pandemic stop. And I'm just imposing some kind of like first world privilege on this whole thing. And really, I should just calm the hell down. And, you know, Jerry Butts saying like, this is just a moment that we're all going to look back on embarrassed that we made this into a partisan thing. Everyone's going to get their vaccine. Calm down. So I don't know. It's hard to separate the signal from the noise here, the partisanship from like, shouldn't we be putting pressure on government to do a better job here? Aren't there questions about how the federal government is handling this? What is your take on this writ large?
Well, I think you're right. I think there is a lot of noise and it's hard to weed through it all. My view is, you know, our vaccine rollout campaign is nothing to write home about. It hasn't been great, but we have to focus on what's controllable now. So I think there'll be time later on for recriminations or whatever we want to do, lashing ourselves, whatever. We can do that in the future. But right now we should focus on what's going on right now and what can we do about it. And what's going on right now is we have ordered a lot of vaccine. It's slow to arrive. So we should be focusing on when it arrives. Let's get it into people as quickly as possible. So I think to me, I like to live in the present. This is what we have to focus on. Let's do it as well as we can going forward.
In the present, Andre, I have a lot of time on my hands for recrimination. I take your point, like what is to be gained by a blame game? But there are a lot of stories. There's sub-stories to this. I mean, there's the question of procurement itself, the deals that our government has signed with pharmaceutical companies. As journalists, we have to be concerned about the secrecy of those deals. It's hard to inform the public about this stuff when we don't know much about it. And then there's copious coverage of this question of vaccine production. Our government telling us, well, we don't have the capabilities. I thought we invested in the capabilities. Why can't we manufacture our own? I've read conflicting reports about that. Then there's this like conflict or the split between federal and provincial governments where certain premiers are taking matters into their own hands and trying to like secure their own supply. There's this COVAX subplot where like Canada is thinking about nabbing vaccines from much poorer countries. And then there's questions about which vaccines we'd be getting if we were to do that thing and the moral questions inherent. And like then there's like a story that I think got lost in this whole thing. This deal that Trudeau made with China where we actually had Canadian research, right? I mean, you must have followed this closer than I. We actually researched a vaccine and we made a deal with a Chinese pharmaceutical company that we would give them the secret formula and then they'd send us back vaccine for testing and then we would share in the profits. And then they just welched on the deal in apparent political payback for Meng. Like, they just didn't send us the vaccines. So there's a lot to keep track of here. When all I really want to know is when am I going to get stabbed in the arm and I can go on vacation?
Yeah, there is a lot to keep track of. There's a lot to be angry about. People can vent and that's all fine. I often come back to, would it be any different if a different government was in place? And I don't think it would be. You know, you can like the Trudeau government, you can like Aaron O'Toole, whatever. I'm not sure that anyone in the current situation would have done any better. That's, I think, we have to remember. Can we produce our own vaccines? Absolutely. There's no reason, but that was something we had to correct 10 years ago. We can't correct it overnight. Maybe we'll do it going forward. That would be great. Other issues like China, I think that deal was not a bad deal on the surface. It's easy for people to say, oh, we should have known China would rip us off, whatever. Easy to say in retrospect, but you know, who can predict geopolitics, how they play out? So I think a lot of these issues have explanations. They don't always have good explanations. They have a lot of excuses sometimes. But I think we have to focus on what can we do now, and we can correct these other longer-term things in the longer term.
I mean, this is like, emotions are raised about this. I mean, I think we probably would otherwise be heading to the polls right, this spring. And it seems that they've pushed back the election because public sentiment has turned against the Liberal government for these very reasons. I guess it's a question of balancing being patient and sober-minded as a population and saying, you know what, it's going to take longer than we would prefer, but we're relatively healthy, we can wait, and there's lots of stuff to consider here, versus this is a democratic country, and we are supposed to hold our leaders to account, and it's fair to judge our government's performance against other governments' performance. There are some apples-to-apples comparisons we can make, and you know that like might affect election outcomes when we do head to the polls, but maybe more pressingly, there's just a lot of unknowns. Like people can't get good information and they can't plan their lives.
Yeah, there's no question there's a lot of unknowns, and some of them are just because we don't know. We don't know how production is going to play out. I think what's interesting to me is I look at a lot of papers around the world and the headlines are the same everywhere. Nobody's happy with their governments. Everybody's really anxious to get this. You know, outside of Israel, I can't think of any country where anyone's satisfied with the vaccine rollout. Now, that doesn't excuse ours being bad. But when I look at these things, I hear people say, oh, we're 52nd in vaccination. If we're 12 next week, that's not going to make me feel any better about this. I'm still going to be critical of it. I think this numbers game in the short term is not very useful and it's not very helpful. I think we will get a large number of vaccines by the end of March. We'll get a lot more by the summer. And I think, you know, aiming for the fall is realistic for most Western countries. And then you have to look at the larger picture, and larger picture being, you know, the old public health maxim that no one is safe until everyone is safe. So, you know, rushing to get healthy 25-year-olds vaccinated in Canada is not going to be useful if no one in Africa is vaccinated. So I think we have to try and balance this stuff out. And that gets lost in kind of the partisan hysteria.
There is something ugly about those lists where, you know, it's such fodder for opinion writers to kind of like, you know, your finger is going up the list and you're like, all right, the Dutch are beating us, but we expect that. We expect Swedes to beat us. And it's really a search for poor countries. Like it's you want that argument point of like, oh, there's some Caribbean country that's doing better than us. Or if there's an African country that's doing, and then you can kind of, you know, you can flip that onto the government and say, look at us, we're doing worse than X. And it is a reflection of some pretty ugly attitudes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we should be looking at countries that have the highest rates of infection and we should be hoping they get vaccinated first. You know, we can look at the US and say, oh, they're vaccinating so many more people. Well, they have a lot more dead people too. We have to balance that out. The priority should be going to places most at risk, not just people most at risk within our country that overall, I think, is doing fair to middling. We're not certainly not the worst in the world. So you have to, if you want to play the stats game, you have to look at other stats other than just vaccination.
I wonder if you're not advising patients in part because of like an awareness of just how ugly this might get. You know, we're getting like recommendations that the way that we roll out vaccines based on who this is affecting, we should prioritize racialized communities because they are disproportionately affected by this. You're looking at a situation where the populace, you're going to be pitting, you know, snowbirds and people who want to see their grandkids against younger parents who have to go to work in a factory setting. Who's more likely to spread it versus who's more deserving to get it? There's kind of like really socially divisive potential in this who gets jabbed first conversation.
That's a very Canadian game, right? Who's more worthy? Who should be first? And I think a lot of that has to just sort of be cast aside. It's about doing it quickly, doing it as efficiently as possible, making difficult choices that are never going to be perfect or right even, but just making decisions and doing it.
Yeah, it's just hard to live in a fog. Like you talk about the fall as the date of us getting the vaccines in the country or getting them in our arm. Is that the date of getting the second dose? What about passports? There's just like so many steps we have to get through to get to the place where everybody wants to get. If we get away from this conversation of should we be angry at government or not, we can certainly agree that people have a legitimate interest in just knowing as much as they can, as soon as they can. Where do you go, like, to cut through the noise and just get the facts and like, your daily checkup on how is the vaccine rollout going today? Where is the best information from your point of view?
I just go to this little website, Vaccine Tracker Canada. It tells us exactly how many doses have arrived, how many have been administered to people, how many people are fully vaccinated. That's all I want to know. The other stuff, you know, if it's coming on Tuesday or Wednesday, It doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. I see those headlines every day, you know, Moderna has been delayed by one day, or it's moved ahead its shipment by 2 days. It doesn't matter. In the grand scheme of things, that stuff's going to all be worked out in the wash.
Andre, on this show, one thing we like to do for our listeners is let them know about news stories that are not getting enough attention or maybe are just deserving of more attention. Do you have something to duly note today?
I think the one that interests me, I've been writing a lot about elder care of late, finishing a book, and I think we've kind of neglected those seniors living in the community. We've paid a lot of attention to what the horrors in long-term care, the vaccine rollout for, you know, getting it into long-term care. But those, so many people just live in the community. We forget that most older people don't live in homes. They live in their own homes. They often live isolated. We've been telling them for a year, stay inside, don't go out, it's dangerous. And a lot of them are living in this just terrible isolation and loneliness. And I think that's going to have a real impact on their health. And it's a really a neglected story, unfortunately.
It seems like very young people and very old people, and this question of the mental health cost, the mental health pandemic that coexists, that's caused by the coronavirus pandemic. It's like there's like this scale. And on the one hand, it's all the things we're trying to do to suppress the virus. And then there's these other health problems that it creates. And at what point does that scale get offset? What are your thoughts on that? Like, have you heard a compelling case for it's actually more important that we get people outdoors? It's more important to, you know, take some reasonable risks for people's mental health and just for people to socialize with each other again?
I think we definitely have to find some balance. You know, going outside is so important. We can't have people living in fear for, you know, isolated, locked away. That's definitely not good for their health. Now, when you have a virus, a pandemic virus, you have to make that the focus, of course. But yeah, you do have to try and find some balance. And again, the vaccine gives us some real hope there that people will be freed from their self-made prisons pretty soon.
All right, duly noted. I want to duly note a situation that our colleague Emily Nicolas is facing right now, but it's not unique to her. Here's the story, Andre. She is a Black woman who writes things on Twitter, and that means that she absorbs a lot of abuse all the time. And she writes also for newspapers like The Gazette and Le Devoir. She gets really horrific responses to everything she writes. But it seems like there was this one tweet where somebody suggested that you know, her publishers, her editor should replace her with a different Black columnist whose opinions they liked better. And in response to that, Emily joked around like sarcastically, like, oh yeah, Black people are just Pokemon cards that, that, you know, that newspaper editors can exchange with each other. What happened next, it seems, and a Facebook user named Xavier Camus seems to have traced this back. There was a campaign amongst right-wing trolls who realized that decontextualize the sentence about Black people being Pokemon cards. This presented an opportunity to report Emily Nicolas' Twitter account to Twitter as being like a hateful account. And if all of these different people reported her for hate speech at the same time, the combination of that many people flagging her and then the fact that her tweet did just like include the words, you know, that the algorithm might be aware of as problematic words, if you're talking about race, it can't discern the context of whether or not you're joking, satire, which side you're on, whether you're quoting somebody. I don't know. They don't disclose what the algorithm makes its decisions based on. But there is a growing body of like cases where racism kind of gets baked into algorithms. And that's something that I'm fascinated with. But in the immediate sense, Emily Nicolas was booted off Twitter. Her account was locked down. And trying to get any kind of accountability from Twitter, from Cameron Gordon, the head of communications for Twitter Canada, by the way, trying to find out who that person is, or, you know, I happen to know that a lot of people don't. It's just the kind of thing where a journalist who relies on Twitter, you know, for better or for worse, this is where we are. I live in fear of losing my Twitter account. The fact that she can be booted off, and the process of booting her off takes hours. The process of getting her account back still hasn't happened yet. This is a problem. And it seems to be a problem that disproportionately happens to Black women. And, you know, it's a disgusting idea that Emily Nicola has a hateful Twitter account. It's just, you know, robots can be fooled, but no human being making an honest assessment of her contributions would ever reach that conclusion. So I think she needs to be reinstated on Twitter as soon as possible. But I think there's a larger issue here where we need some accountability because we are relying on these platforms for our expression.
Yeah, so where to begin? As someone who follows Emily on Twitter, yeah, I think it's outrageous what's happened to her. It shows us the limitations, I think, of some AI, of bots that we use to control our daily communications. And it's a big issue in healthcare. How do we use AI? How do you avoid this racism being baked in? How do you avoid unintended consequences? These are all very complex issues. And this is just a striking example of something stupid happening for probably well-intentioned reasons of people using tools that were designed to root out hate, to be hateful. So it's a lot of the paradoxes of daily life in modern world, in the internet world.
Yeah, I mean, I think Twitter's might have good intentions in trying to create some way of reporting abuse, but I think that the people who are trying to who have gotten Emily booted off temporarily, I hope, are not in good faith and don't have good intentions. And you know, like, we need to stop their ability to do that.
Absolutely. You know, I do spend way too much time on Twitter, and I'm always puzzled by who's blocked, whose tweets are removed, and whose aren't. It often seems very random. Duly noted.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses. But we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. Andre, a report from the AP, the Associated Press, caught my attention this week. Listen, AP collaborated with the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. They spent 9 months investigating to identify who are the super spreaders of coronavirus misinformation. This is like a fascinating journalistic project, big enterprise project of like all of the bad information, the conspiracy theories, the bullshit. And like the virus itself, they could trace it back to a small handful of sources whose erroneous messaging got spread far and wide, and I think is pretty damaging. And they traced it back to two sources with Canadian connections. The first one is the Montreal-based Center for Research on Globalization, globalresearch.ca. Have you heard of this website, this center, before, Andre?
No, I saw that article and I was quite surprised by it. It was new. Most of this was news to me. I don't know. I don't think I knew of any of those people in any great detail. So no, I haven't heard of that institute. But we know that these groups that spread misinformation like to give themselves fancy hoity-toity names.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just pixels on a page. You can kind of look at a legitimate institute and make your site look like that. This site, they have posted more than 40,000 posts since launching in 2001. They were investigated by NATO in 2017 for pro-Russia propaganda and disinformation. I think they started off as like a 9/11 truther website. And this was interesting to us, not just because it's Montreal-based, but because it's led by one Michel Chossudovsky, retired professor of economics from the University of Ottawa. One of our team members remembers Professor Chossudovsky from like pre-2001, like in the late 90s. He was kind of one of the voices on the far left, actually, about an economist who was raising flags about globalization. And the effect of globalization and spreading poverty around the world. So it just goes to show you that this stuff can come from the left or the right. Chossudovsky later, has published all kinds of 9/11 truther nonsense and believes that the U.S. military controls weather patterns. This is where a lot of this stuff comes from globalresearch.ca. And the other Canadian link here is not from a Canadian site, but from a site called Great Game India, in which Canada figures into their mythical coronavirus plot. And their story of where coronavirus comes from is that it was first found in the lungs of a man from Saudi Arabia, and it was then sent to labs in the Netherlands and then Canada. And it was from Canada the Chinese scientists stole coronavirus. And that's where we factor in to the engineering of coronavirus, according to Great Game India. I'm curious from your perspective as a health reporter, like, how big a problem has misinformation been since the pandemic began in your eyes?
You know, I don't think it's often at this level. I don't think a lot of people believe that, you know, this virus was created in a lab, et cetera, taken from a Saudi man or whatever. I think that really far out stuff is pretty marginal.
Do you think that we bear any responsibility for that in the media? Like, I mean, you and I have been talking about this since pretty much the beginning. And I know that you have been careful to balance your messaging, because on the one hand, journalists and especially health reporters, like you, have a very particular and specific role, you and a handful of other health reporters. People look to you as a plain dealer. I think that you have taken that responsibility very seriously and interpreted that in terms of like, well, are you just going to give people all of the information you have, or are you going to measure out what you tell them when? Because we do have a responsibility, especially the early stages, in terms of like managing how people behave. And I'm thinking about in the early days, we were having these debates about like, oh, masks, you know, do we really need them? But there was also a big concern about people hoarding masks. And I think that there were certain public health officials who were, I think, late to talk about certain, just like holding back certain truths about like, of course, it's a reasonable precaution to wear masks, even if the science isn't fully known yet. It couldn't hurt, except for the fact that we're trying to keep the PPE in the hands of health workers at the beginning. But I think people were dissuaded from, you know, in fact, sometimes we were like overtly told that it's you don't need a mask. And I know that like you've got like, you know, on BC, Premier Horgan admitted that he was holding back information from the public because he didn't want to cause hysteria. And I think that places journalists in the middle between public health officials and politicians on the one side and the public who we serve on the other. And when we hold back information, that creates a vacuum into which misinformation can spread. Is there anything to that?
I think there's something, but, you know, it's good to have doubt. It's good to be skeptical, but you have to balance that out with realism, facts, etc. On the holding back of information, I don't think we serve anyone if we just sort of shovel stuff out. You know, here's everything we know, and we're going to shovel it at you, and you're going to have to figure it out. I think we have a job to do some parsing, some analysis to give people, a true picture or as true a picture as we know in that moment. Something like masks, I still get grief over that for saying, you know, in the early days, I said, listen, wear one if you want, but it's not the end of the world if you don't. You have to consider that the important thing is for health workers to wear them. And I would still say that thing that same thing given the same information available at that time. And I think that's what people forget, is that information evolves, we learn more, you have to give people more information depending on the context of what's going on. You know, I've used the description of an onion, you know, so to give people the outer layers. That's what a lot of people want to know. I just need to know the outer layer. Some want to go deeper. And then some, very in few instances, you have to give them so much information that they are brought to tears. You know, you're right to the core of the onion. And that's how I think of information. You give it out depending on the context and the seriousness of an issue.
Was the reason why you were less firm about that, you know, wear a mask if you want, was that because you weren't sure if they were effective? Or was it because you didn't want there to be a run on masks because you were trying to make sure that there wasn't a scarcity of PPE? Like, were you acting, I guess, sort of like as an agent to balance those interests in the way that you convey that information?
No, not really. In that case, it was just more, I was just looking at the research. I think the belief in public health at the time was that masks were important, but not that important. And I think that's changed. That thinking has evolved, and that's a good thing. But, you know, people say, oh, the precautionary principle. Precautionary principle is important, but it doesn't mean do everything all the time. If we had put everyone in a mask last March, maybe we would have prevented some cases, but maybe would have caused other unintended consequences, frightening people, panic. We don't know what the consequences would have been. So I think I always come back to this, but I'm always hesitant to go back and reconsider things in hindsight, given what we know now. It's not that useful.
I mean, I hear you. Like, it's hindsight's 2020. It's just so weird to think back on, like, we were so careful. Like, it was like, wash your hands every 5 minutes. It was like this. I mean, we didn't know then. We thought that surface to surface was going to a much bigger spreader. But it does, looking back on that, and I'm not just talking about your comments, it does look like we were just kind of cavalier about, like, yeah, like, you know, pretty damn good chance that it could be spread through aerosolized droplets, and like, why not? And now we're telling people where to. So when you go back and you look at like Teresa Tam or others, like, it's like, that was strange. Like, it feels like, I mean, scientifically, we now know that, of course, that would have saved lives and been better if we had made that mandatory sooner.
Yeah, absolutely. And if the virus had never gone out in the first place, we'd be safer too. There's all kinds of things that we wish would have happened. And I think the masking one is another example of wishful thinking. We were hoping this wasn't spread human to human. There were some early studies out of China, which we now know were not very kosher, telling us, oh, no, it's not spreading human to human. So there was misinformation from official channels too that confused the issue.
Right. I mean, it looks pretty stupid when I look back at my behavior in January of 2020, why I didn't buy a ticket to Australia for me and my family and just stay there. You know, what the hell was I thinking? Andre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is Canada Land Shortcuts for the week. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. And I read everything that you send. We are on Twitter at CanadaLand. Andre, where can people find you?
Picard on Health.
Our website is CanadaLand.com. Check it out. Sign up for our newsletter. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb with additional production by Kevin Sexton. Our managing editor is Andrea Schmidt. And our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Listen, if you like this podcast, if you like any of our podcasts, if we are informing you, if we're a good part of your life, help us make them. It's easy. It's a click away. Just click on the show notes or go to canadaland.com/join and you'll get ad-free podcasts.